Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson with the Nature Now show for the first week in August. Rumor says this week will bring some cooler weather. Today we'll meet an elusive bird, the marbled murrelet, and a dedicated worker for the bird's survival, Kevin Schmeltzlin. But first, of course, there's the mystery sound. This is one of the few sounds you may hear in a hot, still forest. And observations for this week. Last Friday was a blue moon. It is sometimes said to be the second full moon in a month. That's what most people call it. But it's a bit more complex than that. The moon's timing is a 29.5-day cycle. And the appearance of an extra full moon results from days accumulated in the Gregorian calendar with any month that is over 29.5 days per month, which is most of them except February. I sure hope you saw that moon. It was beautiful. And we have to wait for the next one until January 2018. The jazz standard song Blue Moon does not describe the color. The name Blue Moon seems to be somewhat arbitrary. It turned up in the 19th century farmer's almanac. We don't know why, but it was a blue moon.
The sighting of an unusual but native snake. A hiking friend of Mary Robson, Seth Wolpen, photographed a rubber boa in the West Cascades. The name rubber boa sounds like a joke, but it's native here in western Washington. Even though they tend to live in the same small patches of land year after year, rubber boas overall range from Southern California all the way to British Columbia. It's not Tarzan's boa, but a member of the boa family and the one that lives the farthest north. They prefer cool temperatures, eat small rodents, and reach about 2 feet in length. They do resemble a brown rubber hose. They curl into coils with their heads hidden when threatened. Then they lift their tails. Their tails resemble their head. An attack may hit the tail, which heals more easily than the head. Great write-up and photos of the rubber boa at the Burke Museum site.
Inky's departure. For any of you who have enjoyed seeing Inky, the giant Pacific octopus at the Marine Science Center, she needed a new home. Inky's impressively beautiful and has educated many humans about octopus. She grew and grew, too large for their tanks, and was ready for the Salish Sea. Inky arrived here in 2013 on World Octopus Day, October 8th. She departed on July 21st, 2015, with her fans watching her. Check the Port Townsend Marine Science Center for a video of Inky's life and her release. It includes footage shot by Inky when she was given a camera. Really, where else but the Port Townsend Marine Science Center would you see photos taken by an octopus? Thanks to everyone who cared for Inky as she grew too big for the tank.
Mink? Nan Evans writes, at evening while on our way home from the Natural History Society Book Club, Wendy Feltham, Oma Lanstra, and I saw an American mink crossing Jacob Miller Road with a small vole-like creature in its mouth. These three observers definitely know their mammals and natural history in general. Mink exists throughout Washington, preferring water areas. Nan said they were between marshy and pond locations. Mink swim expertly and hunt for fish, frogs, and crayfish, as well as taking land animals. They can be up to 2 feet in length, 1 foot of it being the tail. Minks are larger than weasels and can live up to 10 years in the wild. Here's an editorial note. They belong in the wild rather than draped on humans.
And finally, unfortunately, we get to hot water, which we seem to be in at the moment. Puget Sound has reached the highest temperatures on record based on 25 years of data, the State Department of Ecology announced last week. Scientists are seeing unusual conditions in the sound as a result of the statewide drought and the pool of unusually warm water in the northern Pacific Ocean, some are calling the blob. Water temperatures measured recently in the Sound are 4 degrees higher than normal, said Christopher Krems, a senior oceanographer at Ecology. We will move on to talk with Kevin Schmeltzlin, who leads the Murrelet Survival Project, and learn more about this small and fascinating bird. Hi, Kevin. I'm very grateful that you're able to be here to talk to us about the Marbled Murrelet. And as a bit of introduction for those of you listening, Kevin Schmeltzlin leads the Murrelet Survival Project, which has members from the Olympic Forest Coalition, the Seattle Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, and the Washington Forest Law Center. And all these entities are working together to help a bird that most of us have not seen. I know its name and its photograph, but I don't know that I will ever see one. And I wondered first, how did you get interested in a bird as elusive as the Marbled Murrelet?
Well, thank you for having me on your program, Mary. Really, what interested me the most about the Marbled Murrelet early on was the fact that this species had been part of the whole northern spotted owl controversy since the late 1980s. Yet despite all the national media attention that the northern spotted owl received, most people, even in Washington State, have never heard of the Marbled Murrelet. So I was excited to be one of the people to bring this species to light. And there was also the thrill of the challenge of protecting a species with little name recognition, as opposed to most of the big conservation campaigns that are centered around the large iconic species, such as the wolf, grizzly bear, and California condor.
Right, and I was thinking about this. This bird is in the auk family, like the puffin. So maybe by the time we finish today, we can have made it as charming as the puffin.
I think that's already as charming as the puffin. Just not as many people have seen them as the puffin. So, yeah, hopefully we'll shed a little bit of light on the species, and people will agree that they're just as charming and just as unique and interesting.
I thought that a good place to start also was describing it a bit and talking about the fact, certainly this bird has been studied consistently since the 1970s, but the nests are still difficult to find and it's hard to study. What makes this true about this bird?
The Marbled Murrelet's a really interesting species because of the fact that it's a seabird that spends 95% of its life in the sea, or saltwater at least, including the Puget Sound. But unlike most of its alcid or auk relatives, like puffins and auks and guillemots, the Marbled Murrelet nests in old-growth and mature forests. They'll lay one egg once a year at most, deep in the forest. Sometimes they'll flying up to 50 miles inland in order to find a big, wide branch high up in the canopy of these old-growth and mature forests.
50 miles? 50 miles. Wow. Okay.
And the further they have to go, the more energy they're spending, the more calories they're spending. So if they do have to fly 50 miles, some individual murrelets may decide that it's not worth it. They have to make that trip several times a day in order to feed their offspring. But they have been known to fly, up to 50 miles, and it has definitely made them difficult to find. And that's why the first Marbled Murrelet nesting site was not discovered until 1974. There's this 200-year mystery of where the Marbled Murrelet lay its egg, because people were just looking up and down the seashore, looking on these small islands near the sea and on the cliff, never expecting that this little bird, about the size of a pigeon, could fly dozens of miles to find a nesting site in the forest. It's really by accident that the first nesting site was discovered.
And it's true that all seabirds, gulls and every other seabird we know about, has to nest out of the water. They all have to do something. But this is just completely unique to the Marbled Murrelet that it does this.
That's correct. Really, the closest species with these nesting behaviors is the closely related Kittlitz's Murrelet, which will fly in order to nest on mountaintops above the timberline. But the Marbled Murrelet is definitely unique in the fact that it's a seabird that nests on branches in these forests.
So it actually brings together two of the iconic places about the Pacific Northwest, the old growth trees and the ocean. It makes it extremely unusual, and maybe that's part of the surprising charm of the bird, that it uses two places that we honor in our own ways, in different ways.
Absolutely, and it is considered to be an indicator species for both ecosystems, the marine ecosystem and the old growth mature forests. But as we've seen the marbled murrelet population decline, this has been a sign that the health of our old growth forests is not doing well at all. Currently, less than 5% of our historic national forests exist in the state of Washington.
Heavens, I didn't realize it was quite that small. The murrelet lives up the Pacific coast from Northern California to Upper Alaska, but it has been more heavily studied in Washington and possibly California. It hasn't been particularly studied in Alaska, has it?
It has not. And actually, there are estimates for how many marbled murrelets there are in Alaska, as well as British Columbia, and what the general population decline has been in both of those areas. But we definitely have a lot more accurate numbers here in the Pacific Northwest, specifically Washington State, Oregon, and California, than in Alaska and British Columbia. And I believe that's just because of the fact that they are listed as threatened here by the federal government in these three states, as opposed to British Columbia and Alaska, where they are not on the federal endangered species list.
That's interesting, because I didn't realize that a creature could be threatened and not be threatened anywhere it appeared. So that the threat has to do with the declining population in this area?
That's correct. In the Pacific Northwest, this species has been known to be in decline since the 1980s, and really since 1974, when the first nesting site was discovered, which allowed researchers to know that there was a connection between the old-growth forests and the marbled murrelet population. And knowing what we know and have known about the decline of our old-growth forests, it was a easy connection for these researchers to realize that the marbled murrelet would follow those trends, since they did have that and do have that strong reliance and a strong correlation with the old growth forests.
The birds are not adapting to making their nests anywhere else.
No, they do exclusively rely on these big, wide branches high up in the canopy. So unlike some species which have adapted to development and urbanization, those things are a negative for the marbled murrelet. The marbled murrelet has not adapted to the development and the deforestation of its forest nesting habitat or the marine issues that it faces, such as oil spills, oil pollution, and the decline of their prey fish populations.
So this is a bird that's extremely faithful to its origins and staying with what it's done forever back in time. I mean, it's not adapting. I was wondering also about it. Everything you read about it says it's plump, it's chunky. I look at it as being shaped like a seal. Is it somewhat insulated from cold water by the shape of its body? Is it storing some blubber or fat to keep itself going in the wintertime?
I do assume that the shape of the body does help insulate it a bit from the cold weather. I don't think any of that blubber, I would say. Their feathers are similar to other alces. They're very water repellent. And that's one of the issues with oil spills and oil pollution, is that the oil has a negative effect on their feathers' water repellent.
So actually, if they get caught in an oil spill, they tend to drown rather than survive?
That's correct. And it's actually thought that possibly up to 25% of the individual birds that perished from the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989 were marbled murrelets.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
So let's just think a little bit more about the bird and then about your project. During this season, late July and August, this is the season when they're raising fledglings?
Right around this time of the year, the fledglings will actually be flying back to the sea, where they'll spend 95% of their life, or 95% of the rest of their life. Mating behavior typically occurs in April or May, with the eggs generally hatching in late spring, typically July, from the beginning of July to the end of July, and a little bit in early August, those fledglings will fly to the sea and begin their life as adults.
And one of the challenges to the marbled murrelet is the survival of fledglings.
That's correct, and that's in large part because of the deforestation of the nesting habitat and also the deforestation of the forest around the habitat, because by breaking up these forests into chunks, basically, it allows corvids, species such as ravens and crows and jays, to go to those clear-cut areas where they'll search for berries and other small fruits. But then once they're done finding those berries, they'll actually go into the forest, sometimes up to 230 meters, in search of more food, where they'll come across marbled murrelet eggs and chicks. And these species, especially ravens and jays, are large enough that they can kick an adult murrelet, off that nesting site if the parent is in fact there, and easily eat the chick or eat the egg. So it's a big problem.
It sounds like a big problem. I mean, I'm not making light of it at all. It's just that it's something you wouldn't expect with all the other dangers that the marbled murrelet faces. So given all of those factors, the Marbled Murrelet Survival Project, a group that works together for them, you got started last fall in response to a clear cut or in response to logging?
Yeah, there were a couple of decisions made by the State Department of Natural Resources in the last few years. And the State Department of Natural Resources is the agency in charge of our state forest lands, which are critically important to the marbled murrelet. And there was a habitat conservation plan, so an agreement signed between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal government, and our State Department of Natural Resources in 1997, saying that the Department of Natural Resources could continue to do logging of the state forest lands in order to generate timber revenue, as long as they contributed to the long-term survival and recovery of the marbled murrelet. And 18 years after signing this agreement, we still don't have a long-term conservation strategy for the murrelet, which was part of the plan. And despite this long delay, in 2012, the Department of Natural Resources passed a minor amendment to that habitat conservation plan, allowing the logging of over 12,000 acres of marbled murrelet habitat. And then our coalition of organizations sued the department and won that lawsuit. But then in 2013, the Department of Natural Resources again tried to do logging in the Olympic Experimental State Forest on the Olympic Peninsula. And this decision, the second decision in 2 years by the Department of Natural Resources to log in habitat that we know is important to the marbled murrelet, really got this coalition of organizations to decide that we need a proactive approach in getting this long-term conservation strategy passed for the marbled murrelet.
So in effect, this is what is now in play for the bird. I mean, that there are the fact of a long-term conservation plan is about to happen or going to happen, or I mean, DNR also, the Department of Natural Resources also has the problem of making money. We all realize that, and that's a kind of conflict in their approach to old growth trees. So I'm hearing you say that in effect you are now trying or working to get a plan executed that is already 18 years old in the process.
Right, yeah. Since 1997, we've been trying to get this strategy passed. And understandably, it took some years. We want this plan to be based on science, but there's no reason for it to have taken 18 years. By most estimates, the plan is over a dozen years late. So although we understand the Department of Natural Resources need to generate revenue for its beneficiaries, which include our public schools and universities and certain counties, we believe that a science-based approach will both help the marbled murrelet and allow the Department of Natural Resources to continue to raise revenue for its beneficiaries in a sustainable and reliable way.
Which all sounds very logical, and we certainly hope it comes to be. I noticed the Seattle Times mentioned that there is a researcher at the University of Wisconsin who is evaluating these plans. How did that come to be?
The Department of Natural Resources has been working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service since 1997 in order to come up with this long-term conservation strategy. And unlike the Department of Natural Resources, which views its primary responsibility as a fiduciary responsibility, which means to raise revenue for its beneficiaries, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is primarily a conservation agency or conservation-minded agency. So we suspect that there has been a difference of opinions between these two agencies. And by hiring this marbled murrelet researcher from University of Wisconsin, Zach Peary, the idea was that they could have a science-backed justification for any alternatives or options for the long-term conservation strategy. So the analysis that Dr. Puri is working on, actually just finished, could be used to justify or potentially scrap different alternatives that could become the long-term conservation strategy. And we do suspect that the, and have been told that the alternative should be coming out in the next month or two. And after a draft environmental impact statement and a public input period, the Board of Natural Resources, which is the supervisory body in charge of the Department of Natural Resources, which is one of those alternatives, become the long-term conservation strategy.
I noticed that since there's all of this happening, that studies and studies and studies have been happening, your quote was that you're hoping that a plan will come that is viable for at least 50 years, long enough to keep the trees growing and the nestlings thriving. Can you comment on that? We're just about at the end of the time we have to consider these elusive and interesting birds. And I just wondered what your thinking was when you thought this would be the ideal plan. It will last long enough to get some survival going on for these birds.
Well, the Habitat Conservation Plan that was signed in 1997 is good for 70 years, meaning that it'll be active through 2067. And the long-term conservation strategy is technically an amendment to that Habitat Conservation Plan. Right now, we're working under an interim conservation strategy, which only protects known occupied nesting sites. And unfortunately, there are not that many, relatively many, known occupied nesting sites. But we are hoping that because this plan is good for the next 52 years or so, that that will allow many of our state forests, which are currently 80, 100, 120 years old, to grow to become highly suitable nesting habitat. And usually the trees that are the most suitable for nesting for marble murrelet are at least 120 years old, generally over 150 years old. So we do need that these trees to mature into really old growth forest. However, in the next 50 years, there is a lot of state forest land that is in the 100 to 120 year age range. So we suspect that a lot of that will become very highly suitable habitat if there's a science-based plan that allows that forest land to get old enough to become that habitat.
Well, so none of these plans can work rapidly, and you are essentially balancing the survival of the existing marble murrelet population with the growth of the trees.
That's correct. The Department of Natural Resources in 2004 hired a team of scientists to get as much information on the marble murrelet and its ecological needs as possible, because we need to remember the first marble murrelet nesting site was not discovered until 1974. So even by the late 1990s, when this habitat conservation plan was signed, there was very little information about the marble murrelet and its ecological needs. So in 2008, this science team came out with recommendations in what is known as the 2008 Science Report. And this science report did balance the needs for protecting current marble murrelet habitat for in the short term while creating optimal habitat in the long term. So we believe that following this best available science, the 2008 Science Report recommendations, quality habitat and important habitat for the marble murrelet, existing habitat for the marble murrelet, will be protected, ensuring that the population will not continue to decline too much further. But in the long run, especially starting in a couple of decades, as these forests mature and grow into higher quality habitat, we do suspect that following this plan, the population will slowly tick upwards, and by the end of the Habitat Conservation Plan in 2067, we'll have a good amount of habitat for the marble murrelet.
That's a hopeful assessment, and I appreciate it as a last word about the process of managing and working with the Murrelet Survival Project. I really appreciate your being here. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. As a last word, there is a book about the marbled murrelet by Maria Mudd Ruth. The book is Rare Bird, Pursuing the Mystery of the Marbled Murrelet. It is a superb piece of writing for the general reader. It tells us about the people who look for murrelets and the murrelets themselves. So, again, that is a rare bird. It is a mountaineer book. We are back to our mystery sound. This is a western chipmunk, familiar to anyone who has ever unwrapped a sandwich while hiking. Wait, perhaps I'm thinking of Girl Scout camp and the pesky chipmunks of the eastern U.S. Here, the rodent, perhaps less pesky, is likely to be Townsend chipmunk, active year-round. They don't hibernate. Their distinctive brown and white stripes distinguish them from squirrels. They eat a mostly vegan diet, with an occasional egg, but mostly seeds, flowers, and berries. Right now, ripe salal berries, nearly through fruiting, would be perfect chipmunk picnics. They sound a bit like the Douglas squirrel, but are less often seen. At least I see them less frequently than I see that little squirrel. Finally, events. On August 8th, there is a puffin cruise. Saturday, August 8th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., you can reserve online at psexpress.co. And if you can believe it, whew, we've been to the sea and the trees and back, and that's it for Nature Now, the first week in August. Hearty thanks to Jacob Brown for engineering skill and keeping us going while Charlie traveled. Welcome back to Charlie Flashman, who could probably fill several shows with his recent adventures, if you were willing. Listen next week to hear Debron Kelso meet with Jean-Marie Morelli. She'll talk on plants and where and how they grow and on soils. We hope you've enjoyed this program of authentic, eclectic, and local news of the natural community where we live. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ, on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the website at www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Today's closing music is Blue Moon Rising, performed by Blue Moon Rising.
How long can this heartbreaking keep hanging on? Blue Moon Rising. To your picture and holding your pillow, your perfume still lingers in the air. I still hear your voice like the wind through the willows. There's pieces of you everywhere. I've had too much time on my hands since you're gone. Chained to your memory, chilled to the bone. Heartbreaking, keep hanging on.